This is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime, 9 o'clock horses, episode 26. Jennifer had returned from Germany and was settled in her third year at Pepperdine. Tuition was high, and she'd taken out a student loan, but in 1985, when President Reagan stopped student loans for high-income families, this put me in a terrible position. John was not rich, but not poor either. In any case, with my business expenses, I had given very little thought to the fact that we did not have enough money for her to complete her fourth year at university. It was heartbreaking to have to tell her that she'd not be able to graduate from Pepperdine. I dreaded the call. To my surprise, when I finally broached the subject, she said, "Oh, well, you know the university needs my 4-point GPA. Statistics are important for them." "I'll tell the dean about your situation. No worries, Mum." I couldn't believe her response. I wept when I received the letter from the university. She had a full scholarship to complete her last year. I knew then she had more savvy than I would ever have. The Jewish term is chutzpah. Jenny graduated summa cum laude and remained at Pepperdine as Year in Europe Coordinator for 4 more years. Pepperdine now offers international programs in Argentina, Italy, Germany, Switzerland, London, China, and Washington, D.C. When she called to tell me that she had been in academia all her life so far, and she was leaving Pepperdine for a new career, I was worried. What would she do? She was fluent in German and had majored in communications, but what sort of employment would she seek? I need not have been concerned. She had applied for a position with a title company in California and was obviously a valued employee. She made a lot of friends at work and realtors who were her clients. One of them was a lovely young man, Brent Preston. He was good-looking and successful. It seemed they were meant for each other. It wasn't long before they were planning their wedding to be held in a beautiful home in Agoura, California. I missed seeing Jenny and Brent on a regular basis, and when she announced they were heading for Colorado, where, with her background, a job was created for her at a major title company, I was very proud. I had always encouraged her independence and ability to stand on her own 2 feet without me. She rarely ever asked me for help. In fact, I began to rely on her for advice and encouragement in my business. Pauline wrote to me often from England. When she called to say that my father was not well and getting worse every day, I immediately said I'd go to see him. How could I not go? She said he needed hip surgery, which he'd declined at 84, and he did not leave the house because he could hardly move. The arthritis was so bad. I had what I thought was a brilliant idea. I could hire a wheelchair and take him to the lovely park that we so often had enjoyed together when I was little. I called Jennifer to tell her what I planned, and she said she could go with me. I had conjured up a whole scene of my father sitting comfortably in the wheelchair as we strolled around the park, talking about the changes, how things were now. He would remember the flowers around the old manor house that had once been my school. He'd comment on the types of trees and the wildflowers in the wooded areas. I could see it all in my mind's eye. I stayed with Jenny and Brent in Denver, and we flew to Heathrow, a night flight, which always exhausted me. After the train ride from London to Leicester, Jenny and I rented a car and picked up a wheelchair from one of the medical supply places for a couple of days. At the house, we were met with handshakes. My father and Douglas seemed pleased to see us. Then Jenny went back to the car and brought in the wheelchair. My father was seated at the table. He said, "And what's that for?" I said, all aglow with enthusiasm, "Well, I thought we could go to the park like we used to, you know, take a stroll around the old school, see some things you and I haven't seen for years, have some good memories." He stared at the chair, then looked at me over the top of his glasses. "You want me to sit in that thing and go outside?" "Yes," I said, "of course. Don't you think it's a good idea? It's the only way you can get around comfortably." His face turned bright red. I won't sit in a wheelchair with a rug over my knees. People will think I'm old." I wanted to laugh, but stopped myself. "Dad," I said, "you are old. We are all getting old, whether we like it or not." At that moment, my brother piped up. "He won't go outside in a wheelchair. Lots of folks have suggested that. So why don't you go away and leave us alone? Every time you come here, you interfere and you spoil things for us." His words cut like a knife, and I stared at him, unable to believe his words. Jenny said, "Come on, Mum, let's go." I looked at my brother. It took a lot of control as I said, "Can't you see how difficult it is for Dad? Without a bed downstairs, he can't get to use the bathroom upstairs. He is a bed down here." Douglas spat out the words. "I help him to get up the stairs to the loo and to bed." "He needs a bed down here," I said. "Just get out," he said quietly. We took the wheelchair back to the medical supply place and I bought a bottle of scotch which we drank at Pauline's house. I was furious, hurt and frustrated. When the phone rang later that evening, I was surprised to hear my father's voice. "Amelia, I think you should apologise to your brother for what happened today." "I? Apologise to him? Shouldn't it be the other way round?" But I didn't say that. Instead, I managed, "Everything will be all right, Dad." Then I put the phone down and had a good cry. We went back to see my father again, but it was very strained, and I was really glad to leave. 2 weeks later, he was in the hospital with congestive heart failure. I was able to leave a message with the nurse who was attending to him in the hospital. I told her to tell my father I loved him very much and everything would be all right with Douglas and me. I hope he got the message, but I never could be sure. At least Pauline was with him when he died, and I was so glad about that. Back in the States, my laundry was selling well, but I had not only increased the line of designs, but I'd begun to make larger sizes. I had the patterns sized at White Stag in Portland. They had all the equipment to make metal patterns for the cutting process. Ewing Line Laundry was becoming well known, except it became necessary to send out past due notices on a regular basis. I had no idea until that time how many businesses worked on credit and were often loath to part with their money long after receiving the goods. Money became tight for us because all our bolts of silk were paid for COD. Then one winter, we hit a big snag, one from which we were never to recover. My order of silk from Japan was held up at Seattle Airport because the quota was filled for the States. I'd no idea that America'd import only so much silk from other countries. The fabric was unavailable for 3 months. We were doomed. We would be a season behind and could not fill orders. I started to have nightmares every night. I went through the days in a blur of indecision. John and I had not taken a salary in all of the 3 years we'd been at the Coal Business Center. I went to the bank to ask for a loan of $75,000. I didn't think that was very much. The manager implied that I had two strikes against me. One, I wasn't a man. And we hadn't been in business for 5 years. I went to the SBA, which is the Small Business Association, and asked for their advice. Nothing doing there. My partners offered more money, but I declined. They had already helped so much. When a woman friend approached me and said she would buy the company from me and I could work for her, I turned it down, too proud to let it go to someone else. How stupid I was. I argued, "Well, I'm the designer, I have to be in charge." As they say, pride comes before a fall, and fall we did. I woke up one morning and decided I must stop the angst that had invaded my life. I had to escape this triangle of emotion, of realizing my ambition of being a designer of note would never happen. And to make money, well, that was a laugh. I had disappointed John and my partners. I walked into the workshop and announced the closing of the factory. I gave the girls a week's notice, plus severance pay. At a sale later, We sold what little remained of the silk for $1 a yard. We sold the machines and all our fixtures. I still wanted to pay back Laurie and Dick, but I couldn't do that. John and I were bankrupt. He hated debt and was beside himself, even considering having to go to a lawyer to set up a Chapter 13, where we would have monthly payments for a long time. I was almost 50 years old and a failure. I wanted to run away. I didn't think I wanted to face another day. Of course, there were a lot of people later who said, well, why hadn't we been a corporation? Then we wouldn't have had to go through bankruptcy. It's nice to know or think about that afterwards. Yes, in hindsight, we could have been a limited liability company, an LLC, which would have protected our assets. As I said, we just didn't think it through. I knew John would always worry about finances, and I said, you know, we could live in another country for much less than we do here. Where do you suggest? He asked. Portugal. That's what we should do. We should live in Portugal. A lot of Brits go there to retire and to Spain. In my mind, the view of the bay and the beach, the villa where I'd stayed in Portugal with Colin, suddenly appeared before my eyes. You mean for good? John asked. Well, I said, let me do some research on living costs and call a couple of letting agents over there. You know, it's only 2 hours from England, and we could always end up there. I'm still a citizen, and it's kind of cheap to live there, too. Oh, God, it's the weather in England, John said. Remember when we visited? It rained every day. True, I said, but I was just thinking about the cost of living. If that's what will make you happy, we'll try it. Poor John. I never realized until later how selfish I was to ask him to leave a country he loved. I had totally disregarded that he, in his 60s, may not want to be moved. He was a homebody. He didn't like to travel anywhere for long. But he went along with my plans. We had an estate sale. He sold his lovely Japanese screens and antique furniture. The house sold too. He must have been so sad. Mayflower movers came to the house and packed our personal belongings in a large wooden crate, ready to be shipped to Honolulu and on to Portugal. It had taken a while with paperwork back and forth, but we contacted the Portuguese consulate and arranged for permission to live there permanently. They were used to expats moving there, I guess, because it didn't seem to be a problem. John's retirement income from Consolidated Freightways was transferred to a bank in Portimão on the south coast of Portugal, the Algarve. When we arrived at the airport in Lisbon, there were armed guards everywhere. We were shut inside a bus and frisked before they let us out into the cold evening. Not a good start, I thought. At that time, apparently, it was standard practice to frisk everyone, no matter who you were or where you'd come from. John had developed a cold. We stayed in Lisbon in a charming private hotel for a week. It was inexpensive and, for me, quite delightful, discovering the narrow, winding streets with washing strung across from one side to the other. On the window ledges, canaries in cages filled the air with birdsong. I also found the green wine delicious, Vino Verde. The food in restaurants was cheap too. The villa in the luxurious resort on the edge of a cliff was much too large for us. We couldn't understand the language. No one seemed to be able to speak English other than the ladies in reception. Of course, I'd been with Colin in the summer. This was winter, and just as cold as England. I found a library locally that had a shelf of books written in England. One of the history books was interesting because it gave some history of Portugal. The Romans occupied southern Portugal long before anyone else. Arabs came and named the Algarve, Algarve, meaning west. It is the west coast of the European continent. The monument of Henry the Navigator is on the westerly end of the coast. He was the fella who sent sailing expeditions to Africa's west coast in the Age of Discovery. The Arabs' influence was particularly evident in the chimneys all around Portugal, However, the chimney in our place did not work worth a damn. The fireplace smoked every time we tried to light a fire. And as the manager said, well, these places are for summer. It took weeks to get used to the long cold nights. We were 3 miles from the nearest town of Portimao, and I felt isolated from civilization. When the water ran brown from the faucet in the kitchen, I tied a nylon stocking to the tap, but it didn't help. And since the tiny on-site grocery store didn't open until April, we had no choice but to walk to the next village along the clifftop to Portimao to buy bottles of fresh water. We turned in the car, deciding it was too expensive while the weather was bad. Now you may wonder why we even stayed there after discovering all the annoying things like lack of heat, having to walk miles for water and food, and pretty much being alone in the resort since, as we'd been told, it was for summer. But in the off-season, it was much cheaper, and if John thought it was terrible, he didn't moan about it. We did take the opportunity to go to Lisbon on the coach that travelled through forest of cork trees. I read up on cork and learned that it comes from the cork oak tree. The layer of bark is called phellum, and it's stripped from the tree in late spring and summer. The bark is harvested every 9 to 10 years, and while the tree is growing more bark, the quality improves. Trees can be harvested for up to 200 years. In Portugal, it's illegal to cut down a cork oak, even if it's dead. It's considered one of the most important commodities, and the workers who harvest the cork bark are highly paid. I noticed, beyond the cork forests closer to the city, there were enclaves of people living in poverty in their cardboard shacks. Tourists tend to ignore the reality of poverty that lies beyond the glamour of a European city. And Portugal has its share of glamour. Beautiful castles like Sintra, fascinating places like the Sandyman Winery, famous for sherry, brandy and Madeira. Portuguese fortified wine is produced exclusively in the Douro Valley in Oporto, north of Lisbon. Our diet when we were at the villa consisted mostly of fish, because when we finally found a local meat market in the village of Portimao, it was quite disgusting. Sides of beef and pork hanging from racks were covered in flies. I didn't even trust the meat in the grocery stores. Inventory was always low for one thing, and it was then I realized that's why everything was so inexpensive. It was still a third world country. We ate fish purchased from boat owners in Alvor. We participated in the weekly sardine dinners held on the quayside, where locals and tourists sat at the long tables enjoying the local vino verde that flowed like water. And there was always the British pub, where Penny, the owner, provided wonderful fish and chips. We became part of the local community. It was nice to know there were a lot of Brits in the Algarve, just a 2-hour flight over the Atlantic from England. When we were there, the Portuguese women dressed in black from head to toe. If the people were poor, the Catholic churches were not. Not with their glorious gold and ornate interiors. I noticed that close to the new resorts, there were half-finished buildings. People ran out of money to build a house because there were no home loans. You either had the cash or you didn't. Portugal now ranks among the top for expensive accommodation and elegant gourmet restaurants. For us, when spring arrived, blanketing the clifftop with yellow wildflowers, we were ready to explore further afield. John looked better than he'd done in years, and he said he felt like a new man. Perhaps the lack of meat and more exercise than he'd ever had in his life did the trick. He looked forward to movie night at the Alvor Hotel, just a mile along the road, to see American movies. The movies had subtitles in Portuguese, of course, and I eventually learned enough of the language to get along just from the subtitles. That summer, we rented a car and went to Spain, which is about 36 miles east of Portimao. The Costa del Sol is full of beautiful resorts, touristy though. Marbella, Mijas and Neuha. But the village of Ronda, way up in the mountains, was fascinating. and our hired guide, Christopher, told us about the influence of the Moors and the Muslims in this 15th century town, with colourful mosaic courtyards, crooked streets with beautiful gardens behind ornate wrought iron gates. Now Granada is a busy city. John drove like a pro, avoiding the cyclists, hundreds of them, and small cars racing around in no particular lane. Then the Alhambra in Granada. It's a Moorish settlement, full of fountains and tiled courtyards, a reminder that royalty lived there in the 13th century. We chose to stay in a government hotel just outside of Seville. It was once a castle owned by King Philippe III in the small village of Lerma, high on a hill. Paradors are enormous. This one at Lerma housed 133 guests, according to the brochure. The food was Tuscan and included lamb, partridge and quail. In the village, there was a small cafe that looked interesting, and I suggested it would be at least warm. It was siesta time, and we were alone in the place, which was just as cold as outside. I said, "Oh, frio, frio, it's cold in here." The proprietor, who nodded to us as we came in, obviously heard my comment, and within a few minutes he arrived with a large metal bowl of hot ashes, which he placed underneath the table. "Calori," he said, "calori." He was right, it was very warm. As the year progressed, I thought John was adapting to our new way of life. When a letter came from a friend in Ashland who said his mother was very sick, John announced he was going home. I suspect that although he never talked much about his mother, she must have been on his mind a lot. Even at 90, she'd always been very fit, so it wasn't an unexpected turn of event. But now John reproached himself. "I shouldn't have left my mother at her age. I don't know what I was thinking." "Oh, John," I said, "I persuaded you. I'm sorry. I dragged you out here without thinking of your mom." He said, "I never would have wanted to miss this, so don't feel bad." "I agreed with you at the time it'd be great, and it has been, but I'm going home, and you should come too." I said, "I can't go back to face our debt from the bankruptcy. No, I can't, not yet." "Amelia, it was nice for a vacation, but I do miss my Monday night football and a lot of other things, and I'm responsible for my mother's estate and all that. You forget I'm 13 years older than you. I don't have the energy to keep going and going. I just want a peaceful place to live in America." I didn't have an answer. He was right. I hadn't given thought to medical facilities in Portugal. Hospitals were few and far between in the Algarve, and the British Hospital for Expats in Lisbon was so far away. Dragging a man who had a bad heart, often in need of medical assistance, to another country was pretty silly. I knew I had to let him go without me. I did not want to return to face the chaos I'd left behind with my business. In Portugal, we were well off. In the US, we'd be back to square one. I did wonder, however, how I was going to manage without John's income, which of course he'd have to stop. He needed it all in the States. One evening in Penny's pub, pondering my future, I sat next to a man who I'd seen before. He was the editor and publisher of a local free newspaper. I told him I loved to travel, and I'd written articles for a few magazines back in the States. He looked at me and smiled. "Why don't you write a column for the newspaper?" "Really?" "Yes, go ahead. About 1,500 words, you know. Write about the area and the things tourists can do while they're visiting. You'll have some legwork to do, but you can visit the local restaurants and pubs. You can interview people. Well, let's see how you do. I can't pay very much, but it might help." I was delighted. It was just what I needed to fill my days without John. I walked everywhere. I found new friends, new places, and described the restaurants and their menus. I wrote profiles on the people who owned the local stores and the small boutiques. Like everywhere abroad, expats found places to gather, to catch up on what was going on at home, and to speak English. I tried to be more conversant with the Portuguese. I used Spanish several times when ordering a coffee or drink. And one time the waiter said to me, "It would be better if Madame spoke English." The proud Portuguese do not appreciate anyone speaking Spanish. The language is similar, but it is not the same. Writing for the tourist newspaper was really fun, but as with most newspapers, the pay was really poor. I had to think carefully about what I could do to sustain myself for at least a few more months. Then I had an idea from Penny at the pub. She kept a lot of books for the Brits to swap. She said she wished she had some fun clothes to sell because the boutiques in the hotels were so expensive for the locals. "Well," I said, I could probably make some sunwear like shorts. Would that work?" She said, "Oh, yes." I borrowed her old Singer sewing machine, took a bus to Lisbon to buy fabric. Well, trying to explain in Portuguese what interfacing is a talent. It must have been quite hilarious. "You know," I said, using my hand to explain, "stiffening for the waistband, the edge of the pockets." It was no use. Finally, after many puzzled looks, the storekeeper led me to a tiny back room filled with bolts of fabric, cotton damask, silk, beautiful stuff. I found the stiffening. He beamed and I smiled. Within a month, I had a line of shorts. It was easy for me to design paper patterns, cut and sew them at the table in the gigantic living room of the villa. Even the small boutiques purchased the shorts from me, and orders began to pour in. Again, like the lingerie business in the beginning, it was just me, one person trying to fill orders. I kept going for another 6 months, spending my time at the pub and meeting lots of other Brits. But eventually, I was tired of sitting alone in the villa in the day, sewing from morning to late afternoon and not getting out to meet people. At that time, a friend of mine from Portland wrote to me and told me she would love to come and visit. Did I have room? "Well, yes," I said. "I have a villa. It's got 4 bedrooms. She was such good company. We travelled on an organised tour to North Africa via Gibraltar, which has been controlled by the Brits since the 1700s. The famous Rock of Gibraltar has miles and miles of tunnels excavated into the limestone, and during World War II, controlled almost all naval traffic into and out of the Mediterranean from the Atlantic. Gibraltar is also home to the Barbary macaque monkeys that have no fear of humans. They're everywhere. A small vessel took us to Tetouan, one of the 2 major ports in northern Morocco. We were taken on the bus to Medina, the old town, and as I was snapping photographs of the Arabs who lined the street, my camera was snatched out of my grasp. "No photographs." The tour guide who had just boarded our bus was firm. "I give it back you later." There were so many unfamiliar sights and smells. Mosques and minarets lined the square. Orange blossom filled the air, as did the singing voice of the Maisin calling for prayer. And cats everywhere in the streets, on the walls, well-fed and friendly cats. In the Kasbah, we enjoyed a dinner of couscous and carrots with lamb while a belly dancer entertained us. Morocco was influenced by the conquistadors from Spain, but the men garbed in white robes, women in black, were a visual reminder of the Muslim way of life. A couple of weeks later, when my friend had left, I knew it was time for me to return to the States. You've been listening to 9 O'Clock Horses, episode 26. Tune in next time to episode 27. This is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Thank you for listening.